Welcome to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, June 1st. I am your reader, Martha Avery, and here's our first story from the front page. Larger than life, photo murals coming to Coralville. Photos will honor the city's 150th anniversary this month. Larger than life photos will go up on buildings around Coralville later this month to celebrate the city's 150th anniversary. The wheat pasted murals will celebrate the city's rich history and bright future, which is the tagline for the sesquicentennial celebration. The murals will be in visible locations in time for the fourth fest, and when thousands of ragbri riders stay overnight in Coralville at the end of July. There couldn't be a better time for all of this, and I think Coralville is going to really shine on the world stage in a way, said artist Isaac Campbell, who is collaborating on the project with the Coralville Public Library. Campbell will also be working on the wheat-pasted murals in each of the overnight ragbri towns, including Coralville. The bike mural will happen the morning of ragbri, which in Coralville is July 28th. They're all going to be so visible, and I think people are going to have fun interacting with them, Campbell said. Wheat pasting is a type of temporary art traditionally used in protests, given its ease and speed of installation. Using flour, water, and sugar, a paste is made to press paper onto a wall, drying with a strong bond. This puzzle method of wheat pasting includes large sheets of paper that are pieced together to create one large image rather than a single large poster, Campbell said. Wheat paste murals tend to fall apart in 3 to 6 months, but can last longer depending on the weather. Historical photos from the Coralville Digital History Library will be wheat pasted onto 7 buildings around town, with each building having its own unique photos. There will be 3 murals celebrating the city's bright future. Photos of students will be wheat pasted on the outside of Northwest Junior High, Kirkwood Elementary, and Coralville Central Elementary. We really want to celebrate both the history and the current diversity of our community and instill a sense of pride in both of these aspects of Coralville, said Ellen Hamp Alexander, assistant director at the Coralville Public Library. The larger-than-life historical photos will be a way for people to learn about and celebrate the city's history, Hamp Alexander said. Coralville librarian Wendy Stevenson said she wants to have QR codes or information about the photos near the murals so people can learn more about their significance. Stevenson oversees the Digital History Library and does archival work. The mural locations will be Chong's Supermarket, Coralville Community Food Pantry, Coralville Public Library, Coralville Recreation Center, Iowa River Power Restaurant, Randy's Flooring, and West Music. Hamp Alexander said the buildings chosen are in a visible, walkable area. Camp said that the murals will take about 1 to 2 hours each to put up, but that can vary depending on the building. Brick buildings tend to be a bit easier because the bricks can be used as guidelines. Campbell spent an afternoon earlier this year with library and city staff driving around Coralville to identify potential locations for the murals. When you put your mural glasses on, you start to see things that you don't normally see. Sides of buildings, walls that are really fun spaces, Campbell said. But it's not quite as simple as at first choosing the image or picking the location. It's very much in the middle of where thinking about images at the same time we're kind of driving around, Campbell explained. Building owners are contacted to see if they'd be interested in participating in Campbell. Campbell then put up a test mural that served as a teaser sample on the side of each building. The test murals were much smaller than actual murals. The tests included the 150th anniversary logo along with Rich History or Bright Future. Before Memorial Day weekend, Campbell went around to see how the tests held up over the last month. He said the tests were in really great condition. There's a practical component of testing the building surface. What can we look for? Is it going to hold up in the way that I think it's going to hold up? But the library also used it for a really great way to promote the project on social media, Campbell said. Students are the bright future. Campbell said that the murals with students' photographs are going to be really moving and a way to show students that they are the bright future. The murals with student photographs are part of a larger effort called the Inside Out Project, a global art platform that helps communities stand for what they believe in and spark change. I think that whether the students realize that yet or not, the fact that they're going to be part of a global community and on a global stage is a really exciting thing. There have been various events over, There have been various events over the last couple of weeks for students to have their photos taken. Hamp Alexander said the Iowa City Community School District has been a great partner in these efforts. It's been so much fun to see how much enthusiasm there is in the community for this project, Hamp Alexander said, adding how excited students have been to get their photos taken. A community effort. Hamp Alexander, Stevenson, and Campbell all highlighted how accessible and collaborative this project and the wheat pasting process is. Students will be invited to help put their photos up, and there will be more volunteers needed. There's a job for everyone, Campbell said. This is not a one-person job. This is a community effort, Campbell said. I don't know that there are many opportunities in public art that are quite like that, where you can get people together in this way to really, like, truly create something like this. You're not watching me do it. You're doing it yourself. You're doing it with me, Campbell added about the process. The images from the Digital History Library are already accessible to everyone online, but now will be accessible just driving down the street, Stevenson said. Campbell said that the efforts from the library to make historical photographs and archives accessible in this way are really cutting edge. That's why libraries are so great, because they already have this mindset of accessibility, of meeting people where they are, making sure that things are available, Campbell said. Another front page story is higher ed enrollment decreases after COVID. Spring counts show losses across Iowa's colleges. Iowa City. Post-secondary enrollment nationally stayed well below pre-COVID levels this spring, down 1.3 million students, or 7% from 2019. And Iowa remained among the hardest hit, with a 13% drop in combined community college, private, and public university enrollments over the 4 years. That 13% tied Iowa for the fifth largest enrollment drop across those sectors nationally, with Texas reporting the biggest loss at 17%, according to new spring enrollment data from the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. When looking at Iowa's public universities only, enrollment in the spring semester that just ended was down 11% from spring 2019, the sixth biggest drop nationally. Across Iowa's private colleges and universities, spring enrollment dropped 9% from 2019, the 11th largest drop. Although Iowa's community college enrollment fell 17% over the four-year span, 22 states reported bigger drops, including some as high as 38% in Colorado and 37% in Texas. With the pandemic now behind us, a new set of factors appears to be preventing students from returning to campuses. National Student Clearinghouse Research Center Executive Director Doug Shapiro said, and these new factors are having a stronger effect on students who are seeking bachelor's degree than on associate seekers. For example, he said, undergraduate students seem to be pursuing different types of credentials with spring enrollment in public and private colleges and universities continuing to show year-over-year losses, while community college enrollment for the first time in years was up this spring. And while other sub-baccalaureate credentials have been experiencing more enrollment interest, graduate-level enrollment saw the biggest year-over-year loss nationally. Graduate-level enrollment drops are almost entirely due to losses in master's programs, down 57,000 students, according to the research center. Although freshman enrollment nationally rose across all sectors this spring from last, where both community colleges and privates each reported a 12% jump in first-year students, public four-year universities saw a much smaller 3% bump, according to the research center. In Iowa, both the University of Iowa and Iowa State University reported meaningful freshman increases in the fall, UI boasting a 15% jump and Iowa State a 6% swell. UNI, on the other hand, saw a 7% drop in first-year students in the fall, erasing gains made despite the pandemic in 2020 and 2021. And as is common, all three this spring lost enrollment from the fall, with UI down 6%, ISU and UNI down 7%, according to the university's registrar and the research center. Selectivity. Some of those semester-to-semester losses relate to the accessible nature of Iowa's public universities, according to UI Associate Vice President for Enrollment Management, Brent Gage. Where some campuses are highly selective about who they admit, taking only high-achieving students who've proven their academic ambitions and work ethic, Iowa public universities must admit all students who meet a certain academic threshold set by the Board of Regents. We're much more open access and less selective than a lot of our peer institutions, Gage said. And the greater your selectivity, typically the greater your retention, because you're doing a lot more selection on the front end. UI for fall 2021 admitted 86% of its 22,434 applicants, well above its peer average of 59%. Iowa State University admitted 91% of its 20,357 applicants that year, above its peer average of 72%. The University of Northern Iowa's 86% admissions rate was level with its regional peers, according to the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System. Meanwhile, for example, the Big Ten's University of Michigan and Illinois admitted 20% and 60% of their tens of thousands of applicants, respectively. So I think we're really pleased with our retention rate, Gage said, just because of all the challenges over the last several years that students faced, whether it was COVID, whether it was online learning, whether it was inflation. Another front page story, amputation saves woman in Davenport building. Crack turned to devastation as structure crumbled under her. 2 days after Quanishia Whiteberry was rescued from the wreckage of a partially collapsed downtown Davenport apartment building, her wife, Lexis, won't leave her side at the hospital. It took a team of first responders and surgeons hours to rescue her. Trapped beneath the rubble at the Davenport, a six-floor building at 324 Main Street, rescuers Monday amputated her left leg above the knee to free her. Just hours before, Lexis and Quanishia were sitting in their fourth floor apartment and noticed a crack above the bathroom door. Lexis snapped a picture, but they both knew something was wrong. Each grabbed one of their two cats to leave, Lexis said. Then everything fell on top of her. Lexis managed to get to the door, but Quanishia was gone. There was nothing left but where I was standing, Lexis told a reporter Sunday night. She watched that night as city officials talked with the media. She urged them from the crowd to continue looking for her wife amid the rubble. In a phone interview Tuesday afternoon, Lexis said that the day of the collapse, she refused to leave the perimeter of the downtown area, except to change into a fresh pair of clothes friends brought her. For her. Friends took her to a restaurant, but she couldn't eat. She had to stay close in case someone contacted her with updates on her wife, and they did. It was a sense of relief because I had been in the dark for so long, but I said, I don't feel like she's gone. I feel like she's just trapped somewhere. I know she's just trapped. She's going to hang on, Lexis said. She was taken to an access door where rescuers had entered the building. A blur of doctors, engineers, and first responders introduced themselves and gave her updates on Quanishia. They said her wife was conscious throughout the ordeal. And she asked, wondering if I was okay, Lexis said. The fact that she's trapped and asked if I'm okay, that's her character. Then, like a game of telephone, first responders reported progress back to Lexis. Every time they got any type of new activity, they'd come and tell me, okay, we're getting closer and closer. We're moving stuff. Lexis said, okay, can't get her now. Okay, we're almost there. But because Quanishia was pinned by debris, rescuers told Lexis that they have to perform an on-site amputation. There was a lot of debris and things surrounding her, and the legs were pinned down, Lexis said. They were able to get one leg out, but the other leg, in order to get her out, they would have to amputate it. They first allowed Lexis a chance to see her wife. They gave me literally just a minute, if not 40 seconds, she said. They gave me a hard hat. And there were about three or four of them that walked me into the building. She said the building was dark, with barely enough of a path to walk in. It was a scene that I'll never forget, Lexis said. I'll never forget that image of the way she was trapped. I just got to say, I love you. You're okay. You got this. Don't worry. She was escorted out of the building before the amputation, but she saw medical personnel administer pain-numbing medication. Then Quanishia was in an ambulance and on the way to the hospital. Lexis was close behind. Quanishia remained hospitalized and heavily sedated Tuesday, Lexis said. A ventilator was helping her breathe and other tubes connect her body to machines and liquids. She said the doctors were going day by day. They're still assessing whether Quanishia will need more surgeries or other treatments. On Tuesday, Lexis was feeling numb, she said, as she tried to process what happened and the plan for the next days and months of recovery. I have to be strong for her. I can't think, why did this happen? I can't go into depression, she said. I just have to be strong for both of us and move forward for both of us. And just know that she is going to be okay. She is going to heal and manifest that for her. I know how strong she is because she was down there for over 7 hours and she survived. So she can survive anything, Lexa said. It's just the feeling of knowing that she's hurt hurts me. I hate to see her in pain. It's really hard to see her in the state that she is. So let's look at some of the top stories for Thursday, June 1st. Iowan returns from mission to space station. Peggy Whitson led the Axion space mission. Astronaut Peggy Whitson of Iowa, who commanded the private spacecraft launched 10 days ago and bound for the International Space Station, safely splashed down with the rest of the crew late Tuesday off the coast of Florida. The crew, commanded by the former NASA astronaut who is now Axiom Space Director of Human Spaceflight, spent 8 days aboard the space station, orbited the Earth 126 times, and traveled 3,331,440 miles, according to Axiom. The craft returned at 10:04 p.m. Iowa time Tuesday. The Falcon 9 rocket from SpaceX, which was chartered by Axiom Space, lifted off May 21st from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, marking the second group of private citizens to fly with Axiom to the space station, and offering a reminder of how quickly human spaceflight is evolving from the days when only national governments had the wherewithal to train and launch people into space. Axiom conducted the training for this flight and commissioned the SpaceX launch. Axiom's long-term goal is to build its own space station in low Earth orbit and continue to send people from all over the world to it. It also holds a contract from NASA to build the spacesuits that astronauts will wear on the surface of the moon as part of the space agency's Artemis program. Axiom did not disclose the cost of the trip, but a previous mission cost $55 million a seat. That first mission in 2022 to the space station included three wealthy business executives who were accompanied by Michael Lopez Alegria, a former NASA astronaut who serves on Axiom as Axiom's chief astronaut. Whitson, who grew up in Beaconsfield in the South Central Iowa and was a keynote speaker at the Gazette's Iowa Ideas Symposium in 2021, is a decorated NASA astronaut who has completed 10 spacewalks and spent 665 days in space, more than any other American. Now as Axiom's Director of Human Spaceflight, the mission built on her impressive legacy with her four space flight missions. She was joined on the mission by Rayana Barnawi, a biomedical researcher who specializes in stem cell research, who became the first woman from Saudi Arabia to go to space. Ali Aquarni, also representing Saudi Arabia, is a former member of the Saudi Air Force and an accomplished pilot. John Schaffner, an American businessman who founded a fiber optic cable company, served as the pilot. He's a lifelong space enthusiast who got his pilot's license when he was 17. Now he flies in air shows and races sports cars. For years, NASA did not allow private citizens to visit the space station, though Russia did. NASA changed its policy in 2019 in a nod to the growing commercial space sector, which the space agency now relies on for a number of crucial missions, including flying its own astronauts to the space station. Axiom plans to launch its first space station model in 2025. That module would be attached to the International Space Station and would help the company get more people to space. And here's a guest editorial from the Dallas Morning News. Title is Get Guns Out of Abuser Hands. Rising temperatures and summertime often mean fun family vacations, but advocates for domestic violence victims see a darker side to these sunny times, a sad rise in the number of calls to their hotlines. With more people spending more time under the same roof, family violence cases typically spike in the summer. The forecast this year is even grimmer in light of the dumbfounding federal appeals court ruling in February allowing guns to remain in the hands of those under protective orders. The U.S. Justice Department in March asked the Supreme Court to overturn that ruling. It's been joined in recent weeks by dozens of law enforcement agencies, public health experts, and advocates for gun and domestic violence victims who have filed impassioned amicus briefs. We support these efforts and urge the Supreme Court to restore the long-standing common sense restriction. The case at the center of the appellate fight involves a Cannondale, Texas man who was under a protective order obtained by his ex-girlfriend forbidding him from possessing guns. The man was sentenced to more than 6 years in prison, but he appealed the protective order, saying preventing his gun possession was unconstitutional. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals originally ruled against him, but the Supreme Court ruled in June that the government must justify gun control laws by showing that they are consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. The New Orleans court subsequently withdrew its earlier decision. And now the Fifth Circuit's ruling hasn't affected the protective orders issued in local state courts for now. But that could change if the high court upholds the decision and state laws come under challenge. Meanwhile, Mimi Sterling, executive director of the Family Place, says the Fifth Circuit's decision was not only a step in the wrong direction, but it has stripped organizations like ours and our agency partners from life-saving legal protections of those we serve. We support the constitutional right to possess guns, but not for everyone and in every case, and that includes anyone violent enough to be bound to a protective order. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I am your reader, Martha Avery. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS programs, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Donald Gene Rompott, Cedar Rapids. Donald Gene Rompott passed peacefully, surrounded by family, on May 30, 2023, and joined Sandra Sue, the love of his life. Don was born on June 12, 1935, at home, the youngest of six siblings. Don was a true bohemian and thoroughly enjoyed dancing to polka music and snacking on Jatternice. In 1960, while shopping at a neighborhood grocery store, he met Sandra Sue Stavely, who would become his wife of 55 years. They married in 1961, had three children, and experienced countless adventures, camping, touring on Hondas, fishing with friends, and spending time with family. Both Don and Sandy enjoyed their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and each generation knew they were truly loved. Don could always be counted on for gifts like light-up tape measures, visiting U.S. Bank on Mount Vernon Road, $2 bills, singing monkeys, and any tool a person could ever need. Don served honorably in the U.S. Army from May 1958 to May 1964 as a mechanic, achieving the rank of sergeant. After leaving the Army, Don spent 38 years as a machinist and quality inspector, starting at Aelis Chalmers with then P&H. After leaving P&H, he hauled feed for Wislicel Farm, when then volunteered delivering meals for Whitwer Senior Center. He shared his love of life with all he met. Betty Jo Ryan, Cedar Rapids. Betty Jo Ryan, 87, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Sunday, May 28, 2023, at Heritage Nursing and Rehab Center. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, June 3, 2023, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, Iowa. Visitation will begin 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will follow at the Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Betty was born on June 9, 1935, in West Virginia, the daughter of Charles and Louisa Ball Kaiser. After graduating high school and moving to Iowa, Betty worked for the Rockwell Collins for 15 years and worked at Target after retirement. On October 25, 1958, Betty was united in marriage to Daniel Joseph Ryan at the Immaculate Conception Church in Cedar Rapids. She was a member of the St. Joseph Catholic Church and a former member of St. Pius X Church, and volunteered at church for funerals, weddings, and at the local food bank. Betty enjoyed life and the people she shared it with. She and Dan's lifelong friends were part of their family as much as any blood relatives, and brought them a lot of joy and memories to treasure. Betty will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. Kenneth Skid Lynn Rowe, North English. Kenneth Skid Lynn Rowe died on Monday, May 29, 2023, at his home in North English at the age of 75. A Celebration of Life memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, June 3rd, at the Powell Funeral Home in North English. Visitation will be on Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home. Memorials may be given to the North English First Responders or Iowa City Hospice. Dalton Anthony Rios, North Liberty. Dalton Anthony Rios, 28, of North Liberty, passed away on Thursday, May 25th, 2023. A visitation for family and friends will be from 2 to 4 p.m. on Saturday, June 3rd, at Lansing Funeral and Cremation, Iowa City. Dalton was born on August 7, 1994, in Iowa City, Iowa, the son of Chris Berger and Victoria Rios. He was a 2012 graduate at West High School and went to Kirkwood Community College. He was currently working as a painter and a farmer. Dalton enjoyed boxing, fishing, skateboarding, motorcycles, and he was a sports enthusiast and loved baseball, and his little brother, Kevin Pendleton. Dalton accepted Jesus as his Savior and encouraged others to do the same. Patricia Ann Dorsey Risdahl, Cedar Rapids. Patricia Ann Dorsey Risdahl, 94, entered her heavenly home peacefully on Sunday, May 28, 2023, at Methodist West Hospital in West Des Moines, Iowa. Woodlands Creek community in Clive, where was Patricia's home for the past 12 years, where she made many friends. Funeral service will be held Friday, June 2nd at 10 a.m. at Gloria Del Lutheran Church in Urbandale. Visitation will be from 9 a.m. until time of service. Luncheon at the church will be immediately follow the service. Interment will be held at 3 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is handling the arrangements. Gregory B. Thompson, Cedar Rapids. Gregory B. Thompson, 65, of Cedar Rapids, passed away May 30, 2023, at St. Luke's Hospice Center in Cedar Rapids. Visitation is 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, June 1, 2023, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Memorial service is at 11 a.m. Friday, June 2nd, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Family only. He was born on January 9, 1958, in Carbondale, Illinois, the son of Horace Francis Thomas Thompson and Sue Ellen Bargesser. He graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in Cedar Rapids in 1976. Greg was married to Jody on September 7, 2002, in Cedar Rapids. Greg worked at Farmstead Packing House for 13 years, Cyrovac for 20 years, and retired from Treehouse in 2018. Greg enjoyed bowling for many years and lots of family gatherings with the children and grandchildren. Greg was a huge Iowa Hawkeyes basketball fan, but probably best remembered by his grandchildren as the Monopoly champion. William Arno Grabe from Swisher. William Arno Grabe, 70, of Swisher, Iowa, was called home to God's kingdom on May 27, 2023. He was born on April 3, 1953, to Ivan and Marianne Grabe. Bill was a loving son, husband, brother, father, and grandfather. He is survived by his parents, Ivan and Marianne, his wife of 36 years, Jan, and his siblings. Bill was a pillar in the community and obtained his real estate license in 1986. He served as president of the Iowa Realty from 2001 to 2011 and became a managing broker at Caldwell Banker Hedges until present. During his tenure, Bill served on multiple committees, boards, foundations, and volunteer programs within the community. He was larger than life and lived every minute to the fullest. His laugh and smile were contagious, and he was the main attraction at every event or social gathering. If he was there, you knew it was going to be a good time. He wore his heart on his sleeve, and he could make a friend in any town, anywhere, anytime. Arlene Gerlach, Toledo. Arlene Gerlach of Toledo went to be with her Lord and Savior on Tuesday, May 30th, 2023, at the age of 91, at the Iowa River Hospice Home in Marshalltown. A funeral service will be held Friday, June 2nd, 2023, at 10:30 at Christ United Methodist Church in Toledo, with Pastor Alan Mulliken officiating. Interment will be followed at the Oak Hill Cemetery in Tama. Visitation will be held Thursday, June 1st from 5 to 7 at the Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama. Arlene Hopper, the youngest of five children, was born on January 27, 1932, to Marshall and Vera, maiden name Schrader, Hopper in Tripoli, Iowa, in Bremer County. She spent her childhood living on various farms in the Toledo area, attending Toledo public schools. After meeting at the National Dairy Cattle Congress, Arlene was united in marriage to Dale Gerlach of St. Ansgar, Iowa, in October 1948. They lived on a farm in St. Ansgar until they moved to their farm in rural Toledo, where they ran a dairy operation. They had three children, Barbara, Vicky, and Stephen, along with eight grandchildren and 18 great-grandchildren. Also surviving is a brother, Bud. Reverend Dr. Richard H. Thomas, Cedar Rapids. The Reverend Dr. Richard H. Thomas, whose contributions as a history professor, architectural historian, Methodist chaplain, and cherished friend, made an indelible impact on Mount Vernon Cornell College, much of Iowa, and beyond, died at age 92 on April 24, 2023, in Cedar Rapids. A public service will be held on Saturday, June 3rd at 1 p.m. on the United Methodist Church of Mount Vernon. The family will be able to greet guests from noon to 1 p.m. and immediately following the service, a private family burial will follow. Francis Allen Ruba, it's spelled V-R-B-A, of Marengo. Francis Allen Ruba, known as Frank, 81, of Marengo, Iowa, passed away May 6, 2023, at Compass Memorial Healthcare in Marengo. Frank was surrounded by family and friends in his final days. Frank Ruba was born January 8, 1942, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to Francis M. and Ruth Ruba. After graduating from Prairie High School in Cedar Rapids, Frank served in the Marines from 1960 to 64 and in the reserves for an additional 2 years. While at Camp Pendleton in California, Frank met his first wife, Madeline Hart. This union brought three children, Janet, Patty, and Frankie. Their family resided in Swisher, Iowa, before settling on an acreage in Marengo, Iowa. After a divorce, Frank married Karen Riegel and had one son, Robert. After Karen's untimely death, Frank met his life partner and love of his life, Kathleen Lucas. This marriage brought Frank a stepdaughter, Bridget, and his family was complete. Frank and Kathleen spent 33 years together before she also preceded him in death in 2013. And the last obituary is Willie James West, Cedar Rapids. Willie James West, 76, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, May 21, 2023, at the Mercy Medical Center. Visitation from 10 to 11 a.m., Saturday, June 3rd, at the Brosh Chapel and the Avon Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2021 Bowling Street, Southwest. Willie was born November 14, 1946, in Camden, Arkansas, the son of Cortez West and Lethrin Browning. He graduated from Lafayette High School in Camden. Willie was united in marriage to Lenora West, and to this union they had three children. They were later divorced but remained friends. He was united in, Theotis Taylor on February 14, 2000. Willie worked at Ford Motor Company for over 32 and a half years, retiring in 2000. He enjoyed fishing, cooking, listening to music, dancing, and playing dominoes. Willie spent his last days with his family in Iowa. Now for a little sports. Girls State Soccer. Marion's state debut ends quickly, but Wolves gave up their bodies to gain experience. Back in March, Marion girls soccer players signed their names on a ball with green ink, a tradition the program established well before any of this year's players were in high school. On Wednesday, they stepped onto Field 6 at the County Soccer Park in Des Moines. sporting green wristbands, just as Marion players have done for countless prior games. So after number 9, Marion's girls' state soccer debut ended in a flash. Second-ranked Class 2A defending champion Dallas Center Grimes needed only one half to generate a Mercy Rule 10-0 win. Marion coach Eric Trilk knew how these players would move forward. As far as this whole experience, I think this group of kids are level-headed enough to understand what they accomplished this year and to be so proud of each other and themselves. Trilk said. The 14th year coach said that with a green t-shirt and green tennis shoes. The green came to red and yellow Marion when the coaching staff discovered a video of Florida women's soccer coach Becky Burley explaining her green dot philosophy. They contacted Burley and were encouraged to go green at Marion. It means going all in for your teammates, Trilk said. What does a green play look like? What does a green teammate look like? What does someone that's yellow or someone that's red look like? Those decisions are in the classroom. Those are the decisions you make when you're at home with your family. Those are the decisions you make with your friends. It's not just soccer related. Understanding the actions that we take have consequences for all the people around us. With 4 starters injured, Trilk said, they literally gave their bodies up to get here. Marion, 12-3, struggled to compete Wednesday. The relentless Mustangs, 16-3, got goals from 7 different players, including a hat trick from Kylie Neef. They're better on grass than they are on film, I'll tell you that, Trilk said. Instead of a halftime team talk, the Wolves consoled each other, accepted their state qualifying trophy, and packed up. Trilk still smiled when he thought about all the Marion soccer balls covered in green autograph that had led to a historic season. We've got one to put in the trophy case this year, which is pretty cool, Trilk said. And now we have partners in puppetry. Bucknell puppets bring magical touch to new History Center exhibit. Being a Bucknell child came with strings attached. All 3 children began working with some aspect of their parents' marionettes as soon as they were big enough to help. Bruce and Nola Bucknell's world-famous marionettes made in their Cedar Rapids workshop aren't your average, everyday, mass-produced puppets. They are intricate works of art that for more than 50 years delighted thousands of children and adults at conventions, churches, parties, and fairs across the country, into Canada, and even on WMT-TV in eastern Iowa, where the Pinhead Brothers starred in commercials debuting the Hy-V jingle, A Helpful Smile in Every Aisle. A selection of original Bucknell marionettes will be smiling from Saturday to November 18th in the second floor gallery of the History Center in Cedar Rapids. The most well-known figure was Billy Bowler, a prospector voiced by Max Han, who became Dr. Max, host of a locally legendary children's show on WMTV from 1961 to 1981. Billy Bowler also starred in commercials for Wilson's Franks and other meats and made appearances at Eagle Food Centers and Lindahl Mall in Cedar Rapids. Since TV was black and white during Billy's heyday, some of the food props were painted in shades of gray, including a rather unappetizing string of hot dogs nestled among the items in Billy's prop shop box. The puppets have been in storage for 30 years, packed so well that they survived the 2020 derecho, safe in the Stone Dairy Barn on on Sandell Bucknell's farm near Cedar Rapids. Out of 60 on loan for the exhibit, about 16 original Bucknell marionettes have come out of hiding for another moment in the spotlight. Bruce and Nola Bucknell, partners in puppetry, also includes vintage photographs, flyers, and memorabilia, video footage of past performances, and the couple's reel-to-reel tapes and history noted on placards. Visitors of all ages can step up to the hands-on corner and try manipulating marionettes purchased for this purpose. But hands off the Bucknell puppets. They are for viewing, not for touching. They're not toys, Dell said. They are very well made and they are beautiful, but they are older in many cases, said Tara Templeman, the History Center's curator and collection manager. They're a little bit fragile, which means that they all need to be protected behind plexiglass or stanchions to keep people from touching them. Because if we have 2,000 people interact with them, they won't hold up to all that kind of wear and tear. All three Bucknell children, brothers Dell and Kurt and their late sister Elaine, made their own puppets and learned how to make them. Dell and Elaine began working in the family business at age 5 and Kurt at age 3. According to History Tidbits, accompanying the exhibit, Elaine put on shows to help pay for college and toured throughout the Midwest in the 1960s. Bruce and Nola continued into the 1970s, then Dell took the reins in the 1980s when Bruce turned his attention to caring for Nola, who developed Alzheimer's disease. The business basically halted after her death in 1988. Bruce died in 1990. Brothers Dell and Kurt are now in their 70s, but they've been brushing up their skills and will perform with the marionettes at 10 and 11:30 a.m. Saturday on the museum's lawn. Tickets are $5, which include entry to the museum that day. Process: largely self-taught, Bruce built more than 300 puppets using old-world craftsmanship. Each one took 300 hours from concept to completion and was made in triplicate so Bruce and Nola could each have one if they were touring separately, leaving the spare at home. According to the opening act placard accompanying the exhibit, Bruce's family moved to Cedar Rapids in 1927 when his father became manager of the Cedar Rapids Fair and Exposition at what is now Hawkeye Downs. Bruce became fascinated with puppets at an early age and was making his puppets by the time he was 10. By 1952, he estimated he had made more than 300 marionettes. His very first one, made in 1934, is included in this exhibit. In his youth, he became known as the kid who played with dolls and left school for a year at age 16 to study with internationally known puppeteer Rufus Rose. Bruce's marionettes debuted at the 1935 Quaker Oats Annual Party. After high school, he worked at Quaker as a millwright, then later became a carpenter and a salesman. All those skills played into his artistry, not only creating the puppets, but building the sets and backgrounds as well. Whatever else he did, he always had the obligation that the marionettes had to come first as a priority, added Kurt, now 71, of Monona. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I am your reader, Martha Avery. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thank you.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.